other thing I want to say to begin with before we get into the lesson this morning was something personal on my part. It occurred to me that Preston Road had a real critical piece in my development as a speaker and a preacher. 1977, 78, 79, I was the preaching intern for the Waterview Church of Christ, where Robert Oglesby was teaching me how to be a preacher. And on the weekends, in the summers, on the weekends, they'd farm us out to different congregations to learn to do stuff. And my assignment this particular Sunday afternoon was to come over here to Preston Road, and I was going to meet one of the guys on your staff that was real active in prison ministry at that time. And he was going to haul me down to the Dallas County Jail, and my assignment that day was to go into the jail and preach into the jail. And as a little kid who'd grown up in Lockwood in Dallas, upper middle class, white, Wonder Bread years, going into the jail was not the thing I really saw myself doing the rest of my life. So I did my little sermon, and I drove over here to Preston Road, and I jumped in his car, and we drove downtown. And he was telling me all the great things about doing prison ministry, but he neglected to tell me what I was walking into. So I get to the jail, the guy takes me up to the top floor there, and I'm behind this metal door with a little porthole in it, and the jailer looks at me and he says, I'm going to open this door, I'm going to let you in, and you're going to be in an enclosed area, about a 3x3 little box in there. And he said, the rest of the inmates are going to be in a holding area, and you just go ahead and preach and do your deal. And I thought, no problem. So he opens the door, puts me in, and I'm in this little cage that's 3x3, and it's got chain link fence going floor to ceiling. And in front of me is a room about half the size of this auditorium with about 60 or 70 inmates, all in the orange, you know, Dallas County Jail, and they're all on picnic tables. And they're all reverse. They're all with their backs toward me. And there's TVs hanging from the ceiling there. And to make matters worse, there's a Dallas Cowboy game going on. So I've got 70 inmates who want to be preached to about as much as, you know, you can imagine. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, what do I do with this thing? Well, the first thing I did was wad up the sermon and threw that thing away. Good move. Second thing I did was I waited for a commercial. And the third thing I did was I remembered a story. And that week, a story had come out about Gene Stallings when he was the defensive back coach for the Dallas Cowboys. Some of you remember Charlie Waters and Cliff Harris and all those guys. So this article had come out in the paper, and it said Stallings was out on the practice field, which up at that time was Abrams and LBJ right there by the Whataburger. And it was right on the highway. We could all stop and watch. Stallings is out on the field that day, and he's looking around in the middle of practice, and he calls the trainer over, and he tells the trainer to go get a tape measure. He goes, he runs it out, and he said, put it on that sideline, run it to that sideline. He walks over and looks at the right-hand sideline of the practice field of the Dallas Cowboys, and it's 3 feet too short. And the Cowboys had been practicing for I don't know how many years on a practice field that was 1 yard too short. And if you're throwing out patterns, you know that 1 yard's a big deal. So I remember that story, and I roll that story out to these inmates. And by the time I get to the end of that story, of course it's in the commercial, I got 50 or 60 or 70 guys who have turned and are looking and they're listening. And at the end of that story, I just looked at them and I said, you know what? I said, maybe the field you've been playing on in your life is a little bit too small, and you need to get a bigger field when you get out of here. And I was riding back with this guy afterwards, and I was thinking about that, and I thought, that story changed everything. So from 19 years to today, I've been collecting stories, because that story saved my life. And you all were part of that, because I wouldn't learn that if I hadn't come to Preston Road and y'all thrown me in prison. You're right. Text. Our text for today is taken out of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy 34, verses 5 through 8 says, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, and the Lord had said, he buried him in Moab in the valley opposite Beth Peor, but to this day no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. The Israelites grieved for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days until the time of weeping and mourning was over. And the highlight there, Moses was 120 when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength was not gone. Likely you've not heard a sermon with this as a text. It's not one of the big ones we turn to typically. My thesis to you this morning is, what if that statement were not extraordinary? What if that statement about his age, his strength, and his abilities was going to become normative? We're going to be talking a little bit this morning about time. Quick story. Oh, a couple of 3 years ago, I was going through the airport. I was coming back from a speaking engagement. I was looking for a book to read. I didn't have any papers to grade. And I walked into the bookstore in the airport, and there was a book in there called The 100-Year Life by Grattan and Scott, a couple of professors at the London School of Business. And I thought, that's real interesting, because I'm an adult education guy. And I grabbed this book, and I started reading this thing, and it was the New York Times bestseller in business. And these guys were walking out the fact that we're in now a third major shift in the world. The first major shift was the technology shift, computers and all that stuff we carry around in our pocket. The second major shift was globalization. Something happens across the world, we hear about it within 5 minutes, and the stock market's crashed. The world has gotten smaller. The third major shift, they say, that's occurring is a shift in longevity. We're all living longer. This is what they say. Let's look at that slide about 1840. Since 1840, there has been an increase in lifespan of about 3 months for every year. That's 2 to 3 years per decade. There's no sign of this trend leveling off. So let's look at this. This is big stuff. So since 1840, every decade, 1850, 1860, the level of health and nutrition and overall well-being in this country and even worldwide has been going up to the point that people are living longer 2 to 3 years for every decade that goes by. Does that make sense? Let's look at the next one. They continue and they say, a child born in the West today has more than a 50% chance of living to be over 105. By contrast, a child born a century ago had less than a 1% chance of living to be 105. So you go down to Margot Perot at Presbyterian today, and the kids born today, predictive average, 50% could live to be over 100. Does that not blow your mind? So let's look at their stats by decade for just a second. Let's go to the next one. If you were born in 2007, you got a 50% chance of living to be 104. If you were born 10 years earlier, 97, 50% chance of living to be 101. If you were born in 1987, you got a 50% chance of living to be 98 to 100. 77, 50% chance of living to be 95 to 98. 67, a 50% chance of living to be 92 to 96. And if you were born in the year I was born, 1957, a 50% chance of living to be 89 and 94. And yes, Jim, wherever you are, I will be drumming those entire years. That's for sure. So what does that mean? It means that our perspective on time and the opportunities that that's giving us is going to shift dramatically. Okay? When I was in graduate school, I studied to be a marriage shrink first, but when I got to Dallas and opened a counseling center for South Mac out in Irving, I started studying up at TWU. And I studied adult education with a guy named Tom Eves, who was just world class. And Tom was teaching us about how adults grow and develop in the 20th century. And what happened, one of the reasons for longevity is in the 20th century, we handled two major problems. The first was childhood illnesses. Why did people die in the early part of the 20th century? Well, childhood diseases. We conquered those. Once that was done, in my parents' generation, we tackled the diseases of middle age. Heart disease. Some of us remember when you'd read on the prayer list, people had stomach ulcers, and people were dying of that stuff. We don't even think about that nowadays. Why? Because medicine is taking care of that. What's medicine aimed at today? It's aimed at diseases of the old age, dementia and Alzheimer's. And they're going to tackle those as well. So what happened in the 20th century was, from an adult development standpoint, we were in a three-stage model. Growth in education as a kid, work through most of your life, and then retirement. And that's what most of us were brought up in. That was the 20th century. And the 20th century gave us two new life stages. One was teenage, adolescence, and the other one was retirement. My dad worked at Pratt Whitney and then at LTV, and when he was 65, boom, I'm done, and I retire and go to Hawaii and have fun. But what's happening today is that lifespan is elongating. It's getting longer and longer. And so what's happening is we have two new life stages being added to the lifespan. You come to Amberton, you take my class in lifespan development. The textbook's going to have two new chapters in the next 5 years. The first stage is occurring back here in the 20s, and it's going to be called pre-commitment. When I was in my 20s, I made all my big commitments. I got married, I had kids, I chose a career, I chose a place to live, I settled down, and I was locked in. Made all those big commitments. Now what's happened to kids in their 20s? Are those commitments being made? No, they're being pushed off to the 30s. They're being delayed some, and people are spending those initial years in what's called pre-commitment. They're exploring things, which is terrific. The one I want to talk to you a little bit about is at the back end of this. At the back end are the late 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, which we used to call elderhood. We used to call that old age. Not anymore. What's going to happen over the next 25 to 30 years is that's going to be called, I love this, drum roll, extended adulthood. If you are now 75 years old, you are no longer in elderhood, you can go to lunch and say, Dr. Don said, I'm in extended adulthood. What does that mean? In pragmatic terms, well, in health terms, it means that folks are going to be living longer, doing well, launching new careers, getting into different relationships, doing many of the things that we were doing back in our 40s and 50s are going to be done later in life. Pragmatically, it means if I'm 65 and I've got a pile of money to retire on, it's not going to last till I'm 95 or 100. So pragmatically, people are going to have to keep doing what? They're just going to keep working to survive. And so it is then that God's community, our faith community, is on the cusp of a very huge shift. And it is in that area that I've been working over the last 2, 3, 4 years and doing a lot of my research, a lot of my teaching, a lot of my thinking about what's it going to mean to be in your 60s, your 70s, and your 80s and being productive and being energetic and being involved in your community, and what does it mean to us as a faith community? Could I share 4 what ifs? What if instead of retiring, we reload? We reload 4 things, possibly. Number 1 is reloading time. Go to any funeral. Mom, we buried her August 27th. She was 99 years old. She had Alzheimer's the last 12 years, and I walked that thing with her. It was rough. And everybody at my mother's funeral said the same thing. She lived 99 years. Her generation averaged 62, so that's how tough a lady she was. But everybody at the funeral said one thing. We had her 99 years, but we wish we'd had just one more what? Just one more day. What's the most precious thing? It's time. Walk this one out with me. Let's look at the slide. If you live 65 years, 70 years, let's say, you've lived 611,000 hours. That's a bunch. If you up that to 100 years, that's 873,000 hours. The gap there is 262,000 hours, extra hours. The book says, the text says, thou art my God, my time are in your hands. So the big question becomes, what am I going to do with what? Time. All that blessing of time. Because if we're mentally sharp, if we're physically sharp, if we've got energy, all of that opportunity. And here's the interesting part about that is, let's say I want to change what I've always done. Let's say I've been over here in business and I want to go to Don's program and become a therapist. I'm not selling that today. You probably need to check your IQ if you want to pull that one off. Not sure that'd be healthy for you, but I have people do that all the time. I've been a businessman, I now want to become a therapist. And they come to Amberton, we do that. Retraining in any general area costs you 10,000 hours. Say, that sounds like a lot. It's not a lot when you compare it to 873,000 hours in your life. So someone says, I want to do something totally different with my life. I want to be a rock drummer. Give me 10,000 hours and I'll have you touring with Lynyrd Skynyrd. Maybe. But my point to this being, we have the opportunity to use a tremendous amount of time, possibly that no generation in the history of man has ever had. Number two is reloading experience. Got a call 2 days ago from one of my best friends in the world, Scott Johnson, that Mike knows real well. Scott's been a consultant with the big international consulting firms, and they've got a retirement out clause that at 62, you're done. And so he's flying into the end of that thing, and his company is going to lose 25 years of his experience, talent, know-how, because it's time out. It's corporate policy. Crazy. He can get more done in 15 minutes working with a group of people that are in conflict than most of us could do in a year. Why? Because he knows how to work that thing. Pick on Mike here for just a second. But every church I worked at, I'd bring Mike Armour in to talk about biblical interpretation. Because our folks didn't know anything about that particularly. And Mike had this great, great story that he would tell. He'd say, I had my desk when I was college president, and in one drawer was the college bylaws and constitution that I was rewriting. And he said, that's one form of literature. And he said, in my other desk drawer were a bunch of letters that Fran and I had exchanged through the years. One were love letters, and the other one were documents for a constitution of a university. He said, is that different literature? Totally different literature. So why would you interpret them the same way? And all our people were going, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mike was great. That was 1990. Mike was great. You listen to his podcast now on leadership, they're 10 times better than that. Why? Because he's got all that experience. He's got all that knowledge. He's been down the road so many times. We're in an organizational rebirth in Amberton. We've got a new president. She's in her first year, Dr. Carol Palmer. I've been with Amberton. Dad taught there in 1970. He was their first accounting professor. I joined him in 84, and I've been there off and on through my whole career. Worked for both the presidents. The board came to us about a year and a half ago. They said, we need a new president. Who would you recommend? And I wrote a page and a half letter to our board, and I said, you need Dr. Carol Palmer. I hired her as a professor. She became our business chairperson. She became academic vice president. I said, she's going to take this university and absolutely turn it and do things that have needed to be done for 20 years. And I said to him, I said, if you'll put her in place, you'll look in 5 years and say, this was the best decision we ever made. And they did it, thankfully. Why could I say that? Because I knew Amberton. I know where all the bodies are buried. I know all our stories. I know all the stupid stuff we do. And I knew Carol, and I know you put those together and you're going to get magic. Why? It's just experience. And so we're going to cash in this new life stage of extended adulthood. We're going to cash in marvelous experience that people bring to bear on life. So there's time, there is wisdom and experience, there is relationships. I'm going to be sending a new book to the publisher here in the next, 60 days. And it's called Rematch. And Rematch is a book that's all about what happens when people fall in love in the second half of life. because that's going to be a big deal. There are going to be people who marry and they stay married and they're married until they one or the other dies, and they will have long-term marriage. And we bless that and we're thankful for that. There are going to be people that never marry. They're going to decide, I'm going to be single and that's my path and my gift and I want to do that, and we bless that. I'm a marriage shrink by training, and I work with folks that are in the other categories. So people that are going to be married and they're going to lose their spouse and they'll be a widow or widower and they'll go, I want to fall in love. There are going to be people who come to the 50s and 60s and 70s and the problems early on in the marriage in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s didn't get fixed. And as a result, that marriage has what we call metal fatigue. It has fissures in the skin of it that eventually drive it apart. And one or the other or the both of them decide at some point in time, I can't do this anymore. It's over. It's out of gas. And they stumble into my office and they'll say, it's over. I just can't do it. I've been doing it for 25, 30 years and I'm done. There'll be all kinds of reasons that people decide in this second half of life to fall in love. Lisa and I just got married October the 5th. We'd both been single for 20 years. We didn't think we'd ever meet anybody to be married to. I think she's having second guesses right now, but she's in it for 2 months and we're doing okay. He's in Houston. I'm here in Dallas. We've been commuting up 45 for 3 years. I came up this weekend. There's a for sale sign in my yard. I've been a Dallasite since 1968. I'm fixing to be a Houstonian. If the Cowboys keep playing the way they're playing, I'll be a Texan fan, I'm afraid. But my point to this being, we would never have met. We met on Match. We met online. And part of what I'm doing in the book and in the seminar that I'm going to be doing about rematching is, how do you fall in love in a new world that's totally different from the world we grew up in? Most of us grew up in a world where you'd call somebody on the phone, get a dorm phone, and someone to call out and say, Mary, you got a call. That day's gone. Dr. James Kale, one of my mentors and a great, great friend, makes a great statement about the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And he says, you know, the need for love, the need for companionship, the need for affection, and all those beautiful things don't end as we get older. In fact, they become more profound and meaningful to us. So we will have an opportunity to reload time. We'll have an opportunity to reload wisdom. We'll have an opportunity to reload relationships. And we'll have an opportunity to reload passion. Passion. What if your best work was not done in your 20s or your 30s? What if your best work was done when you were 75 years old? Or what if God was reserving the peace that he needed you in life for when you're 80 years old? A guy named Dennis came through my class about 4 years ago, and he was first night of class. He's asking a lot of questions. I'm thinking, I got a live one. This guy's going to drive me crazy. It's a marriage and family therapy course. It's a first course for people who think they want to be marriage and family shrinks, and he's in there asking all these questions that are just basic 101. He's completely lost. So at the break, he comes up to me and he says, I'm sorry I'm asking so many questions. I'm sorry I'm doing this. But he said, I'm doing my master's in strategic leadership, MBA guy. He said, I had a 3-hour elective, and I thought, this would be a fun course to do. And I thought, okay, we'll see how you go. So he hangs in there for the first night. Second night he comes in, he comes up after class, and he's saying, I need the names of the books that would help me read more about what you've been talking about tonight. So for the next 10 weeks, every night he's coming up asking for the names of more and more books. Midterm, he hits an A. final exam, master's and MBA, he sets the curve. Next semester in my couples therapy class, guess who's sitting on the front row? Dennis is sitting on the front row, and he's going, man, this is great stuff. The next semester I get a change of degree. He's moved from strategic leadership to marriage and family therapy. 2 years later, I'm standing handing the degrees. There comes Dennis. He's now got his master's degree in marriage and family therapy. He's laughing with me and saying, I'm not going to be a businessman. I'm going to be a marriage shrink. 2 years later, I get a letter from the registrar at one of the major universities in Chicago saying, Dennis has applied for the PhD program. He calls me up and he says, I'm going to be a professor of marriage and family therapy. I'm going to go into private practice. I found my deal. I'm 53 years old and I'm changing my life. I've moved to Chicago and I'm happy as I've ever been. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Now walk that out. He's 57. He's going to roll for another 20, 25 years because I know Dennis. Think of all of the families, all the marriages, all the clients he's going to impact in 25 years. Then think about all of the students he's going to train in his doctoral program as a professor, and think about their career. That's going to go out another 100 years. Dennis, the old MBA strategic leader guy, has just impacted his impact in the world for 75 years on beyond him through his students and his clients, because he looked at his life and said, at 57, I can do something different. Kaboom. I love that. I just love that. Will you reload or will you retire? Spring of 1957, there was a scandal in Burlington, Vermont. There was a Greek businessman named Nicholas Economou, who was 45 years of age, and he had gotten a woman who was 25 years old that worked for him pregnant. He was married, had no children. She was married with four children. And there was no way either of them or their families were going to allow that little baby to be kept in either one of those. So when that little boy was born in Burlington at the major hospital there, he was a ward of the state. And there were no foster homes at that point in time. They were just out. So a call went in to a lady named Susie Trimley. You'll never hear of her again. But in 1957, she was famous in Vermont. She was famous because she was legendary in the foster care business. She had kept mostly kids that were elementary school age that nobody else wanted. She kept them along with her husband on their dairy farm. And she kept kid after kid after kid after kid. And always knew if they had a troubled kid, they could pick up the phone and call Susie. And Susie was now 68 years old and decided it was time for her to retire. So she and her husband retired to their dairy farm and said, we're done with foster care. And we've had a great career. In fact, she was so well known, she was so successful, that when the governor of Vermont and his family needed a nanny, they called Susie and brought Susie in to raise their kids. And so the orphanage in those days in Burlington, Vermont, called Susie on the farm and said, we've got a little baby, a little boy. He's been in one foster care home, and that thing's been a disaster. This kid needs a home. Would you do it what? One more time. Would you reload one more time? She hung up the phone, sat down at the breakfast table with her husband. Carol, I said, well, do you want to do it one more time? He said, well, who is it? A school-age boy? She said, no, it's a baby. It's an infant. It's a newborn. And I'm sure they both looked at each other and said, yeah, at 68, we really want to be raising a newborn baby. That's just what we've been living for. But they did. And they took that little boy in, and they raised him for a year, take him down to the barn in a basket while they'd milk the cows, and they gave him a home, and she became a mother. And in early 58, Will Hebbard, who had moved to Hartford, registered with the state of Connecticut to adopt a boy. And Vermont said, we've got one. And so I was traded, along with three draft choices, to the state of Connecticut and became a Hebbard. And Susie Tremblay was my mother. And I had a mother because somebody said, I will reload. You have a gift of time. I have no idea what God's going to do, for how long it is, or what he's going to put in front of you. But my hunch is he's going to put opportunities in front of you, and he's going to bring people into your life that don't need me. They don't need Mike. They don't need Jeff. They don't need Farland or the elders. They need you. Or specifically who you are. That may be exactly why God had you live this long. Let's pray. Father, we're so grateful for the gift of time. We're so grateful that you've given us opportunities. We just pray that your Spirit will give us eyes to see the opportunities that you have, and will give us the confidence, not in ourselves, but the confidence in your Spirit that empowers us, that you can help us do what we need to do. Bless this fine congregation in all their ministry this year. May they continue the legacy and the heritage that they have in helping Dallas and in touching lives. We pray these things through your Son. And the church said, may God bless you.